Well, good morning, everyone. Wonderful to be in this lovely setting, this lovely forum here. And it's nice to have a Bible study where there are all these antiquities around. You feel almost like you're on the scene. Yeah, we have the pagan altar back there. So today you just started the beginning of Samson, right? So you talked about Jephthah and then the beginning of Samson. And we just started talking about Abimelech last time. So there are things that I wanted to talk about with Abimelech. I want to spend most of the time on Jephthah. I may sort of peek at Samson, but I may not get that far. And our next session, I will devote wholly to, wholly to Samson. There are some things we can talk about. Should I be able to get to it? But the first thing I wanted to point out about Abimelech is what is it? Karen had pointed out last time. Abi, that's like Abba, father, and Melech is king. So even though Gideon says, I'm not going to be king, oddly, he has a son named My Father is King. So evidently there's some ambivalence in terms of Gideon refusing the kingship. He may formally be refusing the kingship, but there's in a way in which it's like people understand him to be a king. And Abimelech is trouble from a young age. Because remember, he is not the son of one of his of Gideon's many wives. He's the son of a Shechemite concubine. So he's the illegitimate child. Now, in our modern age, we tend to be more broad-minded about that sort of thing. So legitimate, illegitimate, that's sort of judgmental, right? I mean, we don't have husbands and wives, we have partners. I remember when my wife and I went for our first session at the hospital when she was expecting, and they kept talking to us about you and your partner. Okay? Because of course they got a room full of people, some of whom are married to each other and some of whom are not. And my wife, who is a very traditional Filipina, she bottled it in, but she was completely insulted. Right? I am not a partner. I am a wife. Right? She did not like that partner business. In any event, one of the characteristics that tended to be true of the societies in which you had wives and mistresses, the sons tended to be the ones, the legitimate sons, tended to be the ones who got discipline and order, and there were higher expectations of them. And the bastard sons, yes, they had this sort of derogatory term for the illegitimate son, they got spoiled. They were sort of let free because there weren't the same kind of expectations on them. So you see this in Hebrews 12 when St. Paul is trying to help his hearers understand why it is that God would allow suffering for the faithful, right? Why do we as believers, why do we as Christians endure suffering? And remember at the time he's writing, great suffering. God chastises every child that is truly His. Right? This is for your discipline. This is for your good. And St. Paul says, it is the illegitimate children who are spoiled. It is the illegitimate children who are sort of let to run wild and behave as they will. Okay? So I think that's something you have to bear in mind with Abimelech here. That there's already a problem because he's the fruit of a relationship that his father shouldn't be having. He shouldn't be having some sort of romantic relationship with a non-Israelite woman. Even if he hasn't perfectly gotten down the monogamy thing, if it's going to be polygamy, it better be polygamy with people of the covenant. Not some relationship with a concubine. Okay? And of course, as he grows older, with a name like that, how is he not going to be ambitious? And so he conspires with people of his own town, of Shechem, to basically wipe out his brothers, wipe out the competition. And you're told in two different places that they are all killed upon one stone, which makes it sound like an act of sacrifice. That they're killed upon a stone implies a kind of sacrificial act. Or at the very least, some form of like public execution. Okay. Remember that with Gideon, you are told that the Spirit of the Lord was with him. Right? There are a limited number of people who get the Spirit. We go on to talk about Samson, right? Remember, the Spirit is talked about several times. But with Abimelech, we're told that there is a spirit that comes, that is an evil spirit that separates him and people. Right? So that's sort of a flag that there's a series of contrasts between Abimelech and his father. Whereas his father is the Spirit of the Lord, this is someone who has an evil spirit. Okay? Think about the way that he wages war. Both of them wage war at night. You know? But his, Abimelech is distinguished by taking people who are hiding out in the sanctuary and burning them. Okay? So we have this image from Gideon of the torches, remember, that put the army in the panic. But here's a guy who's taking refugees, right? Women and children, and exterminating them. Okay? So in other words, there are many points in which he's the opposite of his father. I've mentioned this this writer before. Where is she? The Triumph of Irony in the Book of Judges, Lillian Klein. And I'm indebted to Lillian Klein for drawing a number of these contrasts. Finally, when you think about his death, remember that, as we spoke about last time, that Deborah and Jael are heroes is in a way a kind of a rebuke to the Israelites. Right? It's like the women are doing your work for you. They're doing the kind of work that men should be doing. And that comes out very much in the way that he dies. He gets a millstone dropped on him, and I guess it like crushes part of his skull. And here he is, his dying wish is, please kill me so it doesn't go around that a woman killed me. Right? That's all this guy can think about. Okay? So in his dying hour, He doesn't have any real repentance. He doesn't turn to God. This is a guy who appears to be, with regard to the direction of the Lord, completely unrepentant and incapable of repentance. All he can think about is kind of his own disgrace. Okay? That's all he can think about. And in general, if you look at the trajectory of his life, this is a fellow who was all about personal ambition. It's the very contrast of his father, who hesitated to take on what was being given him by God and gradually had to become confident. This guy is an operator from the start. You're told, remember, that he gets this group of worthless fellows to work for him. So essentially he's going out and getting mercenaries. In contrast to his father, who has the Lord picking people for him. One of the things that Klein mentions is that throughout the chapter on Abimelech, his name is repeated over and over and over again. There's almost a kind of overuse of his name. And in the chapter 10 where he occurs, there's no mention of God. The name of the Lord or Yahweh is not in the chapter at all. Okay? And again, contrast that to Gideon, where there's this frequent back and forth between Gideon and God. God is always sort of present to what Gideon is doing. Okay, so as I think I mentioned last time, you can't look at Gideon or at Abimelech and simply say, well, we had a good king and then we had a lousy king. No, there are ways in which Abimelech springs from the weakness of his father. Now, the very fact that he has this name, right, my father is king, the weak points or the weaknesses of his father's rule, the whole business of the ephod, it comes to fruition in the son. And that's why I think last time I spoke about how it is that you can have people who are very hardworking, self-controlled, admirable people who just have lousy children. And part of that lousiness can be that they don't impose a kind of order on the child which they themselves had and grew up with. So I'm reminded of the way it is that people who grew up during the Great Depression and the Second World War, that once they got into the 50s and 60s, you could have a number of those people be very, very indulgent with their children. You know, we're going to have a color TV, we're going to have a garage, we're going to have a pool, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have our own house. You know, these were people who hadn't grown up with any of those luxuries. So they could enjoy those luxuries, I mean the adults could, and still remember what it was like literally not to have food. Okay. My father, who grew up during the Great Depression, he said it wasn't until he was older that he realized that there were times that he was at dinner that all the children were eating and his parents were not. He said it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I realized that that was happening. And he says, and I remember like it was yesterday, being 5 or 6 years old and having people come to the back door, never to the front because they were shamed, but coming to the back door, knocking, and my mother would make them egg sandwiches. You know, she would fry an egg and put on bread and give them to these people. And when my father told me that, he'd say, that was the kind of thing I looked at, and I said to myself, you know, 5 years old, I said to myself, I never want to be at somebody's back door, you know, begging for egg sandwiches. But so if you grew up during the era, those things are hard, you know, those are hardwired into your brain. Those are burned into your consciousness. But if you've grown up after the 1950s and after the 1960s, it's like all you've ever known is peace and plenty. Okay, occasional recessions, you know? But you know, I don't know that I was scarred by long lines at the gas pump during the Carter administration. You know, I can't say that that was burned into my into my memory the way that my father talks about the Great Depression. So there is a kind of prosperity, there's a kind of an achievement that Gideon has that he is not able to convey that the better parts of his character, the better parts of what he has to offer to this wayward and reckless Abimelech. I'd like at this point to start talking about the narrative of Jephthah. And Jephthah is probably one of the thornier things in this book. And one of the reasons that it's thorny is you are told what Jephthah does. You're told that he's a warrior, that even though he's not, again, he's somebody who's the son of a prostitute, right? He's somebody who's already sort of on the margins. But again, like these sort of outliers, he's got the power, he's got the vim and vigor and musculature. It's like, you know, he didn't go to preparatory school, he hung out with a gang. And now that there's actually some muscle required, you know, having a high GPA actually isn't that helpful. You really are better off having been with the biker gang. You're better off in dealing with the riffraff. So, but in the heat and enthusiasm of fighting the bad guys, he makes this vow that he is going to sacrifice the first person who comes out of the house. Now, he's fighting people who practice human sacrifice. You know, and to some degree, they're successful. And Wordsworth, Christopher Wordsworth, who has these commentaries on this, he says you almost have to look at it from his point of view, that we already are have an abhorrence to human sacrifice. And remember, for these folks, that's something they're having to kind of learn. They don't fully have that in yet. And when you look at the bad guys, and the bad guys are winning, and the bad guys carry out human sacrifice, it's hard not to think, well, you know, maybe they're onto something. Okay. Now, I've more to say about the human sacrifice thing in a bit. In fact, I'll have a lot to say about that. But there's the relation of the, you know, of the narrative of the vow, the daughter coming out, of his remorse, of the sacrifice, of how it's memorialized. But you don't quite get a commentary from Judges, from the narrative, about what you're supposed to think about this. Let me read you something. This is from St. Augustine. And St. Augustine has a series of questions on the book of Judges. And here's what he says about this passage. He says a lot more, but this is kind of an introduction. The scriptures do not seem to pass judgment on this vow and its fulfillment, as it does quite clearly in the case of Abraham, when he was ordered to sacrifice his son and did so. Rather, the scriptures seem only to have recorded the matter and left it to the reader to evaluate, just as in the case of Judah, Jacob's son, who in ignorance lay with his daughter-in-law, but committed fornication by the very act, because he thought her to be a prostitute. The scriptures never approve nor disapprove of the act explicitly, but let the matter stand to be evaluated and contemplated after consulting the righteousness and the law of God. Therefore, the scriptures of God do not offer any comment in either the vow or its fulfillment, so that our mind might be put to work to pass judgment on the matter, and so we might now say that such a vow displeased God and led to the punishment that his only daughter of all people ran out to meet her father. I think the expectation that we can have about the Bible is, you know, that we expect the Bible to be a moralistic book. What do I mean by that? That you're going to get stories, and then at the end of it, there's going to be something like, "Dear reader, the moral of the story is this." You know, that's what we expect. And, you know, once you've been immersed in the book a while, you realize it doesn't work that way. It is not a moralistic book. It is not a moralistic book in the sense that, like, Aesop's fables. You're going to get a fable, you're going to get a moral. You're going to get a fable, you're going to get a moral. There are times that God clearly speaks out in judgment about something. There are times that characters in the narrative will speak out against something that helps shape our response, and we can take that condemnation or that approval to be what it is that we're supposed to, you know, think about the matter. But as Augustine says here, there are plenty of times where we are told things and we are not told what to think about it. Okay? This is an adult book. In other words, this is a book that presupposes that you are going to engage your mind and will in what you are reading. It is not a book where it is simply something that you're reading to a child and you are going to give them explicit direction about what they're supposed to think about this. Okay? Yet you notice that with children's literature, especially the smarmy type. I mean, it's very very pointed. You know, the bad characters are very, very bad. The good characters are very, very good. You know, think about something like The Little Engine That Could. You know that these engines that refuse to come along and carry these cars full of lollipops and toys and things to the other side of the mountain you know they're just arrogant and bad engines, and that the little engine that could, that comes along and says, "I think I can," and you know, it's the evil characters are wearing black, the good characters are wearing white. It's sort of like that. Scripture doesn't proceed like that. You can have, in fact, that's one of the things that's difficult about Samson, is, you know, you read it and this guy is supposed to be a hero at some level, but he's doing these things that just seem dumb, and you're kind of torn. And so that's what I mean by the book being an adult book. If a book is an adult book, it is going to bring you reality as it is. It's not going to create some kind of artificial reality where the bad people are obviously bad and the good people are obviously good, and every action that's bad receives some kind of an immediate punishment in the here and now, and every good action is immediately sort of rewarded right now in the here and now. It isn't that kind of book. I have had students be very puzzled when they're reading the Old Testament, teenagers, because it's almost as if they expect that there's a bad action, like God just, right, smites people, okay? And it's true, there are times that he does, but, you know, there could be plenty of potential smiting going on in the book of Judges that doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because that's not the way it happens in real life. I mean, there are people who are bad, and somehow, boom, they're just singled out. And you sort of get this smug expression on your face. There is a God. Right? There are other times that, you know, the underdog wins. You know, somebody beats the Yankees in the World Series. And you just feel like, yes, right order has been restored. Okay? But God does not, God governs the universe. God does not micromanage the universe. And the biblical narrative reflects, I think, that lack of micromanagement. You know, that there are things that we are really supposed to sort out. What does God want us to think about this? Or what is God allowing for here? What is God making possible? He's not micromanaging. That we have minds and wills, and so we are expected to participate in what it is that God's bringing about. So that brings us now to point three. I've hit the main points of the narrative, and when you read patristic commentary, church fathers, they'll make the point that Augustine was just making. They'll contrast Abraham and Jephthah. So Abraham, when he is willing to sacrifice, you know, Isaac, he does it in obedience to a divine command. And there's something I think that's often overlooked about Abraham's willingness. Because remember, he's been told that he will be the father of many nations. And he's got one, count them, one son. So when he's told to sacrifice Isaac, there has to be a way in which Abraham believes that Isaac's death is not going to be final. That there's some way in which he's getting his son back. In fact, there's this very odd thing when you look at the way it's related in Genesis. That, remember, Isaac and Abraham, they travel together and they have these servants. And they leave the servants and they go to Mount Moriah. And Abraham tells the servants, we will sacrifice and we will come back. He says, we. He doesn't just say, we're going to go to the mountain and I'm coming back. So somehow, when St. Paul will talk about how Abraham had faith and his faith was credited to him as justice, it wasn't just some sort of general faith in God's goodness, nor was it just the specific faith of, I will be the father of many nations. That somehow, even if God commands me to do this, I'm getting my son back. Okay? And that the example that happens through the narrative, that he's about to bring down the knife and the angel speaks to him, right? Abraham, Abraham, do not slay your son. Right? That the example that people get out of that ever afterward is that God is displeased by human sacrifice. That is not what God wants. What God wanted was a ready and obedient heart. You know, and that is what is essential to sacrifice. So I have Psalm 40 up there. Remember, this is the psalm where, I'm going to say about eight verses in, the psalmist is expressing, well, here, you know what? Maybe I should just read it here. The psalmist is expressing the kind of inadequacy of just destroying things on its own terms. So he says, where is this? Whoops. So in some Bibles it's 39, and some it's 40. Verse 6. Sacrifice and offering you do not desire, but you've given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I shall become, behold, I come. In the roll of your book it is written for me. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. Right? That somehow what's essential to sacrifice is this act of the will. That's why it is that later church fathers will talk about how it is that where there's some kind of human sacrifice that would be pleasing to God, it's that the faithful or the martyrs, that even though they are slain by evil men or slain by unbelievers, that they would have a ready heart to offer up their lives to God. So that believers take the lives of each other is detestable. But that, like the example of our Lord, you would be willing to offer up an unjust death out of the love of God or fidelity of God, that is a perfect sacrifice. But that's, again, a sacrifice primarily of the will. It is not, people are not good because they sacrifice you. That's evil. But that your will would be open to losing something precious, you know, because you recognize that it's God's will. You know, that would be, that could be good, that could be noble. Okay, so Jephthah, influenced by the culture around him, he thinks that somehow that this could be something good. And, you know, without that, evidently not considering that example of Abraham, or not considering the law that human sacrifice is detestable, in his enthusiasm, he makes that vow. Okay? And the more common lesson when you read the church fathers on the narrative of Jephthah is the wrongness of rash vows. That you promise things that, you know, would be bad to fulfill. And I think it's St. John Chrysostom who talks about how it is that, you know, why didn't God intervene? Why didn't God, like, you made this vow and, okay, that was a bad idea, don't sacrifice your daughter. No, that forever afterwards, that Jephthah's example would not only prevent human sacrifice, but would prevent that kind of vow from ever being made. And it's true, in the biblical narrative, you never see that kind of vow again. Okay, you never see that kind of vow again. One of the things I thought that would be helpful to bring up, you'll notice my next line there, Plutarch versus De las Casas. Now, you may not be familiar with either of those names, so let me tell you who those two individuals are. Bartolomeo de las Casas was a Spanish writer of the 1500s. He was a churchman. He was a Dominican. And he was the one who wrote one of the more articulate defenses of the native peoples, of the Indian peoples, in the New World. And he made the argument that the Spanish are simply ruining these people. They're treating them with complete injustice. They're slaughtering them in the millions. If we are going to be good Christian people, we need to sort of pull out of the New World or let the Indians be. Okay. And in fact, there was a great debate between him and a fellow named Luis Jiménez Sepúlveda over whether the conquest of the native peoples, of the Indian peoples, was just. Now, in the course of this debate, one of the things that came up was that, you know, these native peoples are carrying out human sacrifice. You know, they believe demonic things. They practice a demonic religion. They're doing things for which they're culpable for doing. You know, at the point where you're carrying out human sacrifice, that's evil and they should know it. So zealous is Bartolomeo de las Casas for the defense of the native peoples that he actually makes the argument that human sacrifice is not against the natural law. Okay? So please understand the term natural law. When I use that term natural law, I mean that there is a code or a standard of right and wrong that is known naturally. That's why we call it the natural law. That it's based on human nature. And that when you look at different cultures around the world, of course there are all sorts of moral differences and disagreements we have. But any culture that you study, you're going to find that they have prohibitions on stealing, that they have prohibitions on killing of various kinds, that they have forms of authority and honor of parents and cherishing of marriage. They're just these basic things that you're going to see over and over and over again because they're human. Okay, this is part of our nature. Try this thought experiment. Can you have a culture where people follow the opposite of the Ten Commandments? Right? Kill! Steal! Commit adultery! Lie! Right? Obviously the society would disintegrate in a week. Okay? There are just certain basic ways that people have, there's certain standards they have to follow, even if they're just going to live together happily and harmoniously. Okay? So here's Bartolomeo de las Casas saying, human sacrifice is not against the natural law. And now, how does he get there? He says, well, you know, naturally, all sorts of cultures out there, they're aware there is a God. And sacrifice is a common form of honoring God. Remember, sacrifice isn't just Jewish or Babylonian or whatnot, right? Sacrifice is all around the world. And isn't it, De las Casas argues, doesn't it stand to reason that human life is the most precious thing? So therefore, the most precious thing you can offer would be a human life. Now, we may know that, you know, that's not what God desires, because that's what God reveals to us. But if you didn't have the Bible, and you didn't have like the story of Abraham and whatnot, or the prohibitions from Deuteronomy, wouldn't it be reasonable to think that sacrificing a human being, the most precious thing there is a way of honoring the gods? Okay. Now, I've by the way, this is something that those of you who have sophomores, they talked about this in the Age of Exploration. Mr. Hester has them read excerpts from Sepulveda and has them read excerpts from De las Casas, you know, because it's a very important debate. The other fellow that I have up there, Plutarch. Plutarch is a pagan writer. He's writing in the 2nd century AD. So there's already Christianity underway, but Plutarch is not a Christian. Plutarch is somebody who's really influenced by probably more Plato than anyone else, but Aristotle and the Stoic tradition and so on. And he has a treatise on superstition. Okay. And one of the things that he's hammering out is that, you know, there are people who are atheists, but atheism does not cause superstition. It's superstition that causes atheism. Okay? He's railing against superstitious belief, because as someone who thinks there's a God and someone who thinks there's order in the universe, you know, superstition gives religion a bad name. And that's why people turn to atheism. And here's the thing that Plutarch says. It's the uncouth actions and ridiculous and senseless passions of superstition, her canting words, her foolish gestures, her charms, her magic, her freakish processions, her foul expiations, vile methods of purgation, her barbarous and inhuman penances, the bemirings of the temples. These give occasions to many to affirm that it would be happier if there were no gods at all than for them to be pleased and delighted with such fantastic toys, and to abuse their votaries, and to be incensed and pacified with trifles. And now, here's a specific example of how religion leads people to atheism. Had it not been much better for so much famed Gauls and Scythians to have neither thought nor imagined nor heard anything of their gods, than to have believed them such as to be pleased with the blood of human sacrifices, and would account such for the most complete and meritorious of expiations? Wouldn't it have been better for the Carthaginians to have some atheist for their first lawmaker, so they might have neither believed in gods nor spirits, than to make such offerings to Saturn as they made? Okay? They knowingly and wittingly themselves devoted their own children, and those that had none of their own bought some from poor people and sacrificed them like lambs and pigeons, the poor mother standing by all the while without either a tear or sigh. And if by chance she fetched a sigh or let a tear fall, she lost the price of her child, but it was nevertheless sacrificed. Okay? So, on the one hand, you have Bartolomeo de las Casas, who is a Dominican priest, arguing that human sacrifice is not against the natural law. And then you have Plutarch, who's a pagan philosopher, arguing that, oh, come on! I mean, the moment that you know that you see human sacrifice, you know this is a demonic religion. You know that it's a phony religion. Okay? You can't predict what people are going to argue, can you? But the reason Plutarch argues what he does is ultimately, I think he does have a better sense of the natural law. That the thing that's going to tip you off that this is a real religion is that it's going to command things that fit with this law that's written on your heart, to use the language of St. Paul. It's not going to command you to sacrifice your children. It's not going to command you to, you know, to buy children from other people and sacrifice them. Okay? That's why ultimately Abraham doesn't believe that somehow his child, that that's the end of it. You know, ultimately he doesn't believe that a good God is simply going to end the life of his child. And De las Casas, out of what I would call an excessive evangelical zeal, really wants to just cut these pagan people a break. He doesn't want them to be as responsible as they are. I mean, we all know people who they've got good Christian hearts, but they want to kind of set a lower bar for people who don't have everything that they have. And setting a lower bar for people who haven't grown up with the gospel, you know, that's reasonable. There are all sorts of things you get from the gospel. But setting a lower bar to the point where you could be clueless about human sacrifice, there are certain things where even though you don't grow up with the gospel, you ought to know better. Even if you don't grow up with the gospel, you still ought to know better. By the way, the response, of course, that you could make to De las Casas is, if you think the Aztecs, for example, are sacrificing because they're offering the thing that's the most precious, why are they sacrificing the people they're conquering? They're not sacrificing Aztecs, right? They're sacrificing these various peoples around them who they subjugated through conquest. Okay? I remember at one point, there was something that I got in my public school about, you know, Indians living together in peace and harmony. And I go home to my father, the anthropologist, and I get this 45-minute lecture on the state of what Indian life was like when Columbus and the conquistadors landed. My father pointed out, why do you think it was so easy for 500 conquistadors to conquer the Aztec Empire? It was because all the nations that the Aztecs had subjugated rose up in rebellion once there was the chance. It was all those other nations. You know, on the morning of the sacrifice, the Temple of the Sun, they sacrificed 10,000 victims a year on the Temple of the Sun. The sides of the temple had to be shining with blood on the morning of the sacrifice. Okay? You know, that's not to say that the conquistadors were somehow a generous and humanitarian group. But if you're like comparing, you know, you're going to go with conquistadors. Yeah, go ahead. Ready? Yes, and that. But again, there are a couple of things you have to point out, that the people who sacrifice Christ Jesus are blamed. They're not doing something good. They're blamed. Remember, Jesus himself says about his own betrayal, you know, the Son of Man, you know, must suffer and die, but, you know, it must be betrayed. But woe to them who betray him. In other words, the pattern that you see starting in the Old Testament is that God is not simply going to wipe evil out and just sort of build on good. That God is going to bring good out of evil. And the very consummation of that is the death of Jesus on the cross. So the atheist, you know, my experience with debating atheists on that point is they want a system where everything is good, God miraculously fixes everything everywhere, and that if he somehow isn't micromanaging with goodness, then it makes you doubt the goodness of God. And that makes perfect sense if God is creating a universe of wind-up toys. That makes perfect sense if God is creating a universe of fuzzy bunnies who run by instinct. If we are going to be genuinely free creatures, then freedom means we have the freedom to reject. So when the atheist sketches out, if there were a loving God, there would be no war, there would be no violence or sickness and so on. And my immediate response is, you know, God loved us and he gave us that world. And we said, no. Adam, that was the world that Adam and Eve had. No. They said no. And now we don't have it anymore. You want a world where human choices don't matter. You want a world where human choices don't matter. Somehow that Adam and Eve could say no. Okay, I'm going to leave you in the garden, but I hope that you change your mind. No, you want a world in which human causality is sort of miraculously circumvented all the time. The miracle is not going to be that God is going to annihilate our will. The miracle is going to be that even with the hardness of our hearts, that somehow God is going to bring goodness out of that. That out of this period of just awful things, that there are these glimmers. There are people who turn. There are people who cooperate. And you really, in a way, you don't see the fruit of it until later. You know, the very things that end up being possible in the world of, let's say, David or Solomon or the kings are first here. Okay? You know, we want everything good at once. And that is not how God works. God is bringing things about through human history, through human action over time. So those who slay Jesus Christ do an evil thing. But out of that evil thing, God brings the salvation of the world. Okay? And that's not easy to take in. It's not. When I was a 11-year-old atheist, and I was first reading C.S. Lewis, when I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the whole thing that's the kind of Christ sacrifice thing with Aslan, and she slays him, and I remember reading that as a kid and thinking that made absolutely no sense to me. I liked the book, but that part of it was just right. It only makes sense to you if it really happened. You know, you remember the line that in terms of literature or narrative, you can write about things that are impossible, but you can't write about things that are improbable. You know, you can with fiction, you can create all these imaginary worlds and so on, but it has to sort of share in reality in some way. And, you know, there has to be some kind of interconsistency. And at the point where you have things like somehow the good character dies and then he comes back and he comes back better than ever, unless that really happens, it's just not believable. You know, there are so many things that unless they really happen, they're not probable. They're not acceptable. I don't know, did that this way? So, Jephthah, that's all a way of saying that, you know, when Jephthah vows to sacrifice his daughter, this is not something that he needs special revelation. And that these pagan peoples are sacrificing human beings in satisfaction of their gods, the plain view of Scripture, and I would say built on nature, is that there is something repugnant about offering human beings to please the gods. That there is something repugnant about that. That ending a human life just by itself is not something that pleases God. That even when we talk about the sacrifice of Jesus, it's not the flesh and blood death that's essential so much as the sacrifice of the will that goes along with it. That's what's primary. It's that Jesus offers himself. It's the offering that's there that's essential. How are we doing on time? Problem with this room is I don't have a clock. It's 11:10? Yeah. Okay. Then let me just say one thing about Shibboleth, and we'll adjourn here. I knew I wouldn't quite get to Samson. Remember, this is in chapter 12, and it's the Ephraimites. They're trying to get away. And when they get to the river, they're told, well, say the word Shibboleth, and we'll let you cross. The problem is, in their language, they don't have the SH, so for them it sounds like Sibboleth. And the moment they say that, they mark themselves. Now, you might think that that's something that's just, you know, in the Bible, and these things don't actually happen in reality. No, they do. If you look this up, there was an article in Wikipedia, but there are other places. During World War II, during the American occupation of the Philippines, you would have Japanese agents there who were pretending to be Filipino. And they would have them say Lollapalooza. And if what came out was Roarapap, they killed them right then. Filipinos do not have problems with L's and R's. You know, their language is in that sense like ours. But Japanese, they can't do Lollapalooza. Okay? They can't do that. So, believe it or not, I mean, that's a 20th century example. There are all sorts of examples that in war between the Dutch and the Germans, there are sounds that are in Dutch that are not in German. So they would use those as shibboleths. They would use that as ways of identifying. The New Zealanders and the Australians, they have not had a war, but there is this shibboleth that you can tell them from each other. Apparently, the Australians, when they say fish and chips, to New Zealanders, it sounds like fish and chips. Okay, to the Australians, the New Zealanders sound like fush and chups. Okay, so if you have them say fish and chips, you can tell whether it's a New Zealander or Australian. Okay, so there are these. One of my favorite examples. Hopefully, New Englanders won't go to war with the rest of the United States. But the way you would tell is you would ask them, okay, I want you to say that word. And if they say ka, you know it's a New Englander. In fact, I had a friend, he grew up in Merrimack, New Hampshire. So he grew up, you know, smack in the middle of New England. But his father grew up in California. And his mother was French Canadian, so his accent didn't come from the locals. You know, it came from his own home. And he remembers in grade school this girl just looking at him. Why do you keep saying car? Why don't you say it like a normal person? Car. Here he is getting corrected because he's pronouncing the R. Karen.
I have an example. My daughter's name is Shoshana, and we have the SH. Greek doesn't.
Yes.
So in Greek, her name is Susanna.
Yeah, Susanna. Yep. So there's a shibboleth. You know, if they can't say that SH, you know they weren't wrong. Well, very good. So next time we will focus on the first two chapters. We'll focus on the narrative of kind of the infancy narrative of Samson, and then his early activity. And really, the next two classes, I'll focus entirely on Samson. Very good. Thank you.